So we're going to do a bit of a raid as we'll start to talk. We're just waiting on a couple of guests, but in the meantime, please welcome onto the stage, Mr. Paul Freeman.
I don't know whether this is the dust cart coming after the Lord Mayor show or before. We'll have to see how good the other guys are when they get here. Can you all hear me anyway?
Can you hear me now? Is that
yes.
Better?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit. Where should we start? Anyone want to start with the topic?
Yeah.
Oh, Hot Fuzz. Well, that was a very unique opportunity. I was playing with a lot of guys that I grew up with as an actor, people I'd always worked with and spent time with. And that normally never happens in the job, you know. You might be one or two older guys of my age, but that's it. But to have a whole gang, it was like being with your posse again, you know. Fantastic. And Simon himself is just Simon, absolutely. As you see him, is what he is. So charming and funny, and very easy. No surprises there, then.
No dirt on that one, was
no
it?
No dirt. Yeah. Who do you want the dirt on?
Who have you got it on?
Who's safe?
No, I don't think we were that long to talk, have we? So let's talk about your experience on Raiders of the Lost Ark then. You know, how did the role come about? And,
you know. I was just started making some movies. I'd made Long Good Friday and then The Dogs of War, and I was finishing The Dogs of War in the Caribbean. And I had this call to go to Los Angeles and meet Spielberg. And in The Dogs of War, my wife was playing the part, and we got together. And after the shoot, we went to New Orleans, which is where I got this call. And I said, well, I'm in New Orleans. I said, well, you go up to LA. And I had no idea. I'd never been out of Britain much before. Certainly hadn't been to the States. I had no idea how big it was. So I tried to rent a car to drive from New Orleans to Los Angeles overnight.
There's two dodgy looking characters just behind you there.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Anthony Higgins, Mr. Wolf Carla. That's where the fun stops down there. Yeah. You have to be serious.
Thanks for the warm up. I thought you were doing rather well.
I was holding the fort is what I was doing. I said I'm just the front fourth. Shall I just finish answering that?
Yes, please.
Where was I? So eventually I got to Los Angeles and I went to, I was called to a meeting with Lucas and Spielberg, you two probably know all this, in their offices there, which was a small one-story brick building, a sort of bungalow, at the entrance to Universal Studios. And it was the old office of the Egg Marketing Board, and it had Egg Marketing Board still written across the door. And when I was ushered in, Spielberg and Lucas were on the floor. And they were listening to what was a really new piece of innovative equipment, a little cassette player like this with separate speakers. I think it was only the second time I'd seen one. And they were bowled over by it. And we all got down on the floor and just listened to this sound for a long time. And out of that, they said, well, do you want to go and read the script? And I went next door and read the script and read the thing about the monkey eating the date and thought, this is going to be great fun. I have to do this. I have to say, I wasn't very bothered because I just met my wife. I really couldn't have cared less. I wasn't sort of bowled over by it, which is always a very useful state to be in if you're going for a job. There we are.
And what about you two guys? It was, how did the role in Raiders come about?
I went to see Steven Spielberg in Ed's Tree in the studio, and obviously been invited by the casting lady to go there, and I don't think I had much of an idea what it was about, and I had a little chat with Spielberg, and he just said how he admired Stanley Kubrick, and as I was very lucky to have had a little part in Barry Lyndon, I I agreed with him, and we started chatting about that the film a bit. And kind of that was basically it. He said, nice to meet you. And yes, and I got the part. So I thought in that it was basically because of my work with Kubrick, but I found out later that The Lady Vanishes, that I had filmed just a year or 2 years before, was actually shown in the States just a year before, in 79. So, and there's a little bit of an action part I had in that one, so I suppose I kept running around and things. So I think they thought I could, you know, do a little bit of action and I was in uniform there as well, so that probably helped. A different color, but it was a black one. That film, it was very nice. That in the final scene, seeing the train driving off, and I didn't manage to stop it. I was there, kind of just with a long face, looking after it, and could see blonde hair in those days, and it was a very nice picture. Me as well, blonde hair in my uniform, but it was actually only that I was shown with my hair, with my blonde hair, because the wardrobe had forgotten my cap. You know, my hat for that scene, and it was kind of too far away from their caravan to get it. So, probably they could see as well. Probably even could see a little bit more of my face then. That may have helped a little to get the part. Anyway, it was quite wonderful, and a lot of. I saw a couple of other very well known, much. Better known than me at the time, coming from them. It was obviously a big film, lots of interest in that. So yes, that's how I got into it, and until we went to Luton to get the chartered flight to La Rochelle with everybody on board, and that was it.
And what about yourself, Anthony? How did you do audition for the part? Or?
Well, I must throw in an anecdote here, which Wolf has just brought to mind. Where, when you mentioned uniforms, I'd completely forgotten until you mentioned it. The one night after we'd been shooting, this was in the Sahara, I mean, in extreme heat. And we were being driven back. We were in the back of a limo in full uniform, me as a major in the Africa Corps and you as a colonel or whatever. And a group of German tourists went past us, a whole convoy of them in jeeps who were crossing the desert. And they just literally, people say, you know, they were gobsmacked. Their jaws were just, they couldn't work it up. And I just stared across at this one particular one and gave the Hitler-Schöne Gruß, and they were absolutely horrified. Do you remember that?
No, I'm sorry. I looked the other way at the time. Sorry. No,
I think Stephen had seen me playing a German in a film called Voyage of the Damned. Which was an extraordinary true story about how the Nazis allowed about 800 Jews to leave Hamburg in a liner, and no one would take them. And I was playing a good German in it. I went to see Stephen, and we hit it off. And I could speak German too, which I suppose is was necessary. I was constantly being corrected by Herr Kahler.
I refute that. I don't think so. I wouldn't do that.
He's too polite. Just to hear from you. Okay. Stephen was, when I first met him, was he was a surprise in this kind of other way, in that there's absolutely nothing showy about him at all, not in his dress, not in his manner. He's not vain. But what he has is the most terrifying encyclopedic knowledge of film. You think of the most obscure film, where it could be anything, a British film made in 1952 or whatever. He'll tell you not only about the film, he'll tell you which lens a particular scene was on and what height the camera was at. And he just has this real appetite for and love of film. And that's what he has learned to manifest in his work.
Anthony, you remind me, is this story true? This is a story I've repeated several times, but I haven't seen you guys in so many years. To do with the German tourists. There came a point in the filming when George Lucas decided, looking back, I think he decided to teach us all a lesson, as actors, this is my memory of it. And he wrote in some scenes that weren't in the original script and employed these German tourists, mainly young men, blonde young men, of course, to do these scenes. And while we were meant to be working, and we were told to sit down while these people did these scenes, and I remember saying to each other that this will never appear in the final film, and it didn't, but it was a sort of, and I believe Lucas is quite famous for giving little lessons about, don't think you're the most important people around here.
Well, he actually ended that episode, which was bizarre in the extreme, by saying, so who needs actors?
Do you remember? That's right. Well, I thought I'd imagined that bit.
No, it's absolutely true. It was a scene where a boy was going to be, had to execute someone, and those were his orders. And everything about his nature rebelled against that, but he knew he had to do it. And he was very effective in it. But I thought that was singularly ungracious of him to stage that. And of course it wasn't in it. But then neither was our... Do you remember, you think about the temperatures we were shooting in. It was 50 degrees easily, wasn't it? It was hotter than a sauna, if you can imagine that. And Wolf and I had a scene where John Rhys-Davies who was cooking some ghastly, revolting-looking brown meal, had to shower us with this boiling hot curry. Do you remember that? Our costumes were completely covered in this stuff. You've forgotten, haven't you?
I've got a photo of is it you or myself being totally in,
yeah,
being wetted down. I when I come home tonight, I'll double check who was the wettest in that scene. But it's very clearly, and I remember in that same sequence that I think I wanted to kill Salah. I don't know if it was as a result of getting wet. I don't think so, but there was one reason, and that was where the German tourists, I think, came in, that I had the pistol, I think I drew my pistol, and I probably aimed at Salah, I don't know, but Salah, I didn't do it. Anyway, he did survive. But I gave my pistol to that German tourist. For him, I mean, he didn't in the film, he was not supposed to be a tourist. He was, of course, a soldier. I gave him my gun, as far as I remember, to shoot him. I didn't want to get my hands dirty, I suppose. And
you were somewhere down here with the gravy, which was slightly different. What was the gravy story?
That was John Rhys-Davies. The scene was cut. It doesn't appear in the movie. He had this pot of boiling hot food, brown food, which I can't even remember what triggered it. He covered us with, he had a ladle, and he covered both of us with his hot food. I remember the...
I really don't know. I can't remember that, Anthony, but I remember something slightly different as well, that we came to blows, I think the two of us, nearly. It was a very strange scene, and I think from my perspective, that's where you ended up wet. But as I say, you leave me your phone number, I'll tell you tonight how it all ended.
This has turned into three old men trying to have a conversation in the old folks home, isn't it, when nobody can quite remember.
Yeah, so it's only 36 years ago. Yeah.
And you mentioned before George Lucas saying, you know, who needs actors? Now he's notoriously known for not liking work with actors. How was it being directed by him?
Well, shall I go first? He doesn't really direct. He shouts at you during the scene. Turn to the head. Turn your head to the right. Turn your head to the left. And you just sort of think, okay, that's what you want. I'll do it. Simple as that, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly an aspect. But I think I mentioned that before because I think he was on the way. He gave us a lot of freedom to do in a scene, to which you I think countered that at some point a few years back somewhere. You say yeah, but there's the camera, so you can't just go there because the camera's there or whatever. I mean that's understood, that you know, basic setup. Has to be made before a scene is shot. But I think that emotionally, contents-wise, and delivery-wise, I think he gave us a pretty good leeway there to do our characters. Yeah, I think that was very good, very cleverly, of course, held in check, you know, by the basic setups. So. There was already a limit to what you can do. You had to follow the moves. Sure. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Any questions from the audience?
Yeah, down the front here.
Should be a roaming mic somewhere.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, this is a bit off-piste. It's about John Gielgud, who I adored, and was notoriously vague, but also waspish. And this was apropos George Lucas, when I said, I never really took him in. And I was working with John in Vienna, and he was talking about a film he'd done, an American TV film for Hallmark Hall of Fame. And I said, oh, John, who directed that? And he said, I never really took him in. He hadn't noticed who the director was. He just did his shtick. It's probably a very good note for after a certain age as an actor.
My favourite scene in all of the Indiana Jones films is the desert chase. I wonder what your recollections were of filming that scene.
I tell you mine, just I had... No, through the Oasis. Was driving a Bren gun carrier, which was so loud, I cannot possibly describe to you this when it was firing. It's right behind my head. But I noticed that my goggles steamed up on the inside, so I could see fuck all. Before we shot, I memorized the track. And then I did it, I think, twice. And really, to be honest, it was blind. I was just doing it from memory and praying that I didn't hit one of these bloody palm trees. And of course, they're very difficult vehicles to drive because the gearbox is a crash gearbox, you know? So you have to return the gear stick to neutral, then give it gas and clutch again before you put it in the next thing. So it's called double declutching. So that was going on, the Bren gun in the back, and I couldn't see a bloody thing.
Is that why you drove off the cliff then?
may well be. Yeah.
Do you have any memory about that, Wolf? Because I was in the back of the Mercedes with you, wasn't I?
We had a very nice drive, I think. very comfortable. And our driver, the stuntman driver, he liked as well to drive adventurously. It was nice.
Oh, yes, I remember
it. Sudden stops.
As you passed, you put your fingers up and said, check your billing.
I think if you look carefully, you'll see, too, that the driver of our car later reappears as somebody else coming in through the window of the wagon. Really? In fact, if you look closely at that whole sequence, those stunt guys reappear all the time.
Yeah, he was brilliant. What was his name? Sunday or something like that. No, he was a very, very famous stuntman. He died, I think, a year ago.
Rocky Taylor?
Rocky, that's right, it was Rocky. Yeah, yeah.
Have you got another question? Yeah, just right next to it.
So, Wolf, you'd not played, you'd actually played a Nazi before in a film with Harrison Ford, Force 10 from Navarro. Did any rapport carry over from doing that, working with him previously on Force 10 to Raise the Lost Ark?
I doubt that very much. I played a German soldier in a warehouse.
Yeah.
And I don't think I was a Nazi. I mean, of course, people say Nazi, I mean Germans, but it was not. He was certainly not a Nazi, and he had to look after his gear not Robert Fox, what's his name?
Edward,
thank you. Edward Fox, he pinched one of my wheelbarrows. And I said, come on, you know, put it back, or whatever. And he just walked on and with increasing speed with the wheelbarrow. And actually, just before he disappeared, he I think he got the biggest laugh in the film by turning around and doing this to me. You know, so... I just had to improvise a little dialogue. They're shouting after him, and that wasn't very nice words I used there. You know, something like whatever. I was really cross. And the funny thing was that, or the nice thing was, at the end of the day, of my day's shooting, Robert
Shaw.
Shaw, thank you. Robert Shaw, he was in the scene, but he was just sitting there somewhere, enjoying the, watching this little scene there. And at the end of the day, the producer or director, he asked me, what do you do tomorrow? And I said, I don't know, I'll be at home, I think. And he said, would you like to come round again to the studio tomorrow? I said, yeah. He said, there is a pilot who flying down on the village and kind of shooting everybody there. And I said, yeah, fine, yeah, yes, okay, sure. And then next day I was put into a uniform, pilot's uniform, quite different to the greenish uniform I wore the day before, and even had some lines. But it was, you know, like that, you couldn't really hear the voice properly. So I did that another day's work. And when I watched the movie long, long time, probably decades later or something like that, and I saw the credits, and there was, so-and-so Wolf Kahler, and then pilot Hans Kahler. So I had two credits on that film, which is pretty unique. That was Force 10 for me. It was nice. That was nice. Little side note there.
Okay, have we got another question? How different is it for you guys, sort of, for example, with Indiana Jones kind of being a big action film? Like, how different is it working on a kind of really action-based shoot, whether it's for TV or film, in comparison to something very, like, maybe character-based? Like, what's the difference on set for you guys?
yes. I mean, to be action. I mean, it's an action film, an action movie, but like the Raiders. I know there's a lot of stuff going on, but it's basically, it's all to me, it's all character work being put, you know, sitting here or standing there or whatever. But it's the character. The action is done either, you know, by stuntmen or whatever. But it's. It's just another level of the portrayal of things. So I don't think there really is much of an extra effort, you know, compared to a quiet whatever I've ever seen. Things are louder, things are probably faster, but that's the car that's fast. It's not us sitting there really more, you know. This, more drama, sitting somewhere quietly, somewhere, different scenario.
Yes, I think that's the key to it, Rolf, is to be rooted in the character. It was just coming to mind there as you were talking, doing a Moses with Ben Kingsley. Christopher Lee was in it, and Frank Langella, and this was in Morocco in the desert. And we had to a lot of imagining the plagues of Egypt and parting the Red Sea and all that stuff. And it's the kind of thing where you could feel extremely silly doing it, but you have to step over that and go back to the thing that children have naturally, which is the ability to switch make-believe on and off and enjoy the process of imagining these millions of locusts descending on you, or the rain of blood, or the what happens when the Red Sea opens, but rooted in character is what it says.
There is an advantage, of course, in an action movie is that you don't have lines to learn for the most part. That's a profound advantage, and something that I bore in mind years ago when I read an interview with Gregory Peck, who said when he gets his script, he writes NAR on various scenes, meaning no acting required. That doesn't mean that he's lazy. What it means is that when he gets to those scenes, which are generally action-doing scenes, he does it. He's an actor. When he's going through a door, running through a door, falling over, he does it. There's no acting required. It also means he doesn't have to learn any lines that day, but that's by the way.
What was it like for you, Paul, working with Karen Allen?
Well, Karen knows a theatre actress, and I was straight out of theatre, but just made a couple of films before. But so we were very happy about rehearsing, and Harrison didn't want to rehearse at all. He wasn't a theatre actor, and Spielberg wasn't interested in rehearsing. He told Karen and I to go away and improvise the drinking scene in the tent, and more or less, I think that. How it appears is our improvisation. I don't think there was any particular written dialogue before we did that. They were perfectly happy with what we did, just they didn't want to be part of that process.
Got any more questions? Got time for one more? Yep, so two hands go up. It's always like, yeah, have that one first, and then we'll go to the other one.
You spoke about the temperature in Tunisia. Did you face any other challenges while filming in the desert?
Well, and dysentery mainly, which hit everybody except Spielberg and one of the producers.
And Colonel Dietrich as well. He didn't fall for it.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Really?
I think the famous story. What's that?
Sorry. Go on. No, Anthony doesn't believe me, but believe me, I did not fall for it.
He's flogged it. I mean, it hit me on the last day. I don't know about you. We were just finishing the shooting, and I found myself, you know, I had to sit cramped up, dying to get to a bathroom. And Spielberg came and sat next to me, so I felt I had to talk to him about, about that. But hold some conversation with him. I really couldn't talk at all. I was concentrating so hard. And the famous story about that, of course, is that scene, the wonderful scene where Harrison pulls a gun and shoots the big guy in black with a sword. And they had rehearsed, it's on the documentary footage, they rehearsed that scene. And when they came to shoot it the next day, Harrison had fallen ill and he couldn't even stand up. So he said, why don't I pull a gun and shoot the fucker? That's how it happened.
That may be in your
imagination.
No, it's not in your imagination. It was, I think, in the director's of the documentary imagination, because I only read a few months ago that was he wasn't in top form probably, but it had been decided quite a while ago not to do. It's too stereotypical again to go into this in a big fight and whatever. To do it as a different one this time, do just a, you know, quick one. I'm sorry about that, but I had to debunk. That it's a myth. It sounds very nice and very charming, but no. I am sorry.
Now you've spoiled it for everybody, haven't you?
I wasn't present on the day. I prefer the romantic version, the imaginative version.
Okay, so we do that last question. So it was going towards the back, was it?
Did any of you manage to walk away with any props at all from the films?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Did you manage to walk away with any props from the films?
Did you steal anything, basically, is what you're saying?
Careful what you say.
The sand in your shoes.
I don't think I did. I really don't think I did.
No. My son, he was really quite upset that I didn't even bring the cap home. So, no.
No, not me. It wouldn't cross my mind to take stuff back.
It was tutting then. You don't want them to steal stuff. Well, we have unfortunately run out of time. So,
you guys weren't out there in those days. We wouldn't have been able to sell it anywhere.
That's very true, yeah. We have run out of time, so put your hands together and thank you.